Hello and welcome to GCSE English Revision Pods. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2020, to a new decade, to a lot of you, to your GCSE year, of course. So we are going to try and provide you with as many podcasts as we can to help with those upcoming exams. Today, we are focusing on a text that involves the duplicity and duality of man, the fact that within each of us lies two different sides to ourselves, a potion that unlocks them. We are, of course, talking about Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
No.
Of course we're not. We are talking about Robert Louis Stevenson's classic novel, Jekyll and Hyde. And where are we going to be going with that today, Mr. Forster?
Yeah, I mean, well, just to contextualise what we're doing, we've already done episodes on Hyde as a Dangerous Outsider, on the importance of place, and on Mr. Utterson. And I had a few of my old class, before I moved schools, were quite worried about some of the question on Lanyon, you know, looking at some of the minor questions. So I thought it'd be really worth looking at Lanyon as a character question.
Absolutely. And Lanyon is a great example because, as with any question in this novella, you don't end up just talking about Lanyon. You end up talking about Lanyon's relationship with Mr. Hyde and Dr. Jekyll. And I think that is a very, very important thing to keep in mind whenever you are approaching Jekyll and Hyde. You are almost always going to end up talking about either Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde. And if you talk about Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde, Mr. Forster, what must you do?
Always talk about the fact that they are the same.
They are the same, and talk about their alter ego as well. Let's get straight into it.
Yeah, so the extract scene from chapter 9, where Hyde visits Lanyon. So actually, just to be clear, dear listener, this is obviously the epistolary section of the novel. What does epistolary mean, Mr. Galley?
This is when we are basically finding out what happened, right? We are reading the letters which have been left to us by dead characters in the play and learning...
It's not a play, it's a novella.
And learning what all these mysteries that have been set up, all of this Victorian Gothic confusion has been leading to.
Yeah, so this is an incredibly important moment because it's the moments before we find out the truth about Jekyll and Hyde and the fact that they are the same. So the question is, the extract, if you haven't downloaded the handout yet, please go and download that from the bio of the episode.
Absolutely, go there now. Click back on your podcast app. If you click underneath the play button, there will be a description of this episode. And in that description, there is a link to a handout which will help you, will give you all the key vocabulary and give you the question we're working from and the analysis we're going to be talking about. So go, 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 do that now.
Welcome back.
And welcome back.
So the question is, how does Stevenson present the relationship between Dr. Jekyll or Hyde and Dr. Lanyon?
Yeah, and that is quite a tricky question. Initially, you might see that and be a little bit panicked that that's the one that has come up. But actually, I think there is a huge amount to say about this. And particularly if you look at the extract, which Mr. Forster has kindly highlighted for you as well, you will see that this is the moment where Hyde is tempting Lanyon. He's almost saying, do you want to know? Do you, like Eve being tempted in the Garden of Eden with the apple from the tree of knowledge, do you want to know the answers to these terrible questions that have been plaguing you?
And obviously Lanyon here kind of functions as the surrogate reader. You know, he stands in for us because this is, whilst being a Gothic novel, it's also very much a mystery novel. And
we want to know, right? We want to know the answer to these questions.
Who is Mr. Hyde? So if we look at our thesis statement, in Stevenson's 1886 novella, Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Lanyon is characterised as a foil to the eponymous doctor, representing a more ethical and moral approach to science. Their relationship, therefore, ultimately comes to allegorically represent wider fin de siècle debates about the place and role of science in a world where religion was losing significance.
Well, I think you need to unpick that last bit a little bit. What's a fin de siècle?
So fin de siècle is literally a fancy way of saying end of the century. Famously, it refers to the end of the 19th century. So, and the reason I mention that is because it's also a period in literature, which where the kind of the end of the Gothic period. So it's There were lots of debates in this fin de siècle period coming from Charles Darwin's writing on the origin of species in the mid-19th century, coming from the Age of Enlightenment, which is, you know, the time of scientific advancement through the 18th and 19th centuries. And so we're exploring, therefore, in this essay, how Lanyon and Jekyll represent two different approaches to science that are kind of filling the vacuum left by religion.
Right, so Lanyon is presented as a character who, while he is a man of science, he also respects the limits of science, right? He's seen as perhaps a more traditional character, one who acknowledges the power of science, but also is a little bit scared of science, right? Is a little bit wary of taking it too far, whereas Jekyll is seen as someone who is so intoxicated and excited by the power of science that he sees Lanyon as weak, and he sees that the logical thing to do is to take science as far as you can possibly take it. Yeah,
the great AO3 comparison would be with the earlier novel by Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, with Dr. Frankenstein. Is that these kind of represent people who push the limits of human understanding and push the limits of human morality. So the idea of Lanyon as a foil to Jekyll is going to be at the heart of our essay, because a foil is, of course, two characters who are deliberately juxtaposed, representing different sides to a debate.
To reflect like a piece of foil, to reflect the opposite of the other character, like Mercutio and Romeo, as we've talked about in earlier podcasts.
Yeah. So in paragraph one, I think we always start off by looking at the extract in an extract question. It's a logical place to start your essay. And generally in a 45-minute essay, you've probably got about enough time for maybe three, possibly four paragraphs, plus an introduction and conclusion. So it makes sense to start by looking at the extract. So our first thesis statement is, in the extract taken from the penultimate chapter, Lanyon is presented as a foil to Jekyll, with Stevenson presenting Hyde as a satanic figure, trying to tempt him to evil with the promise of a seemingly supernatural knowledge.
Fantastic. Right. So Lanyon is this character who's faced with a decision, and Hyde is enjoying this moment, isn't he? He's enjoying the power that he has because he knows that the knowledge that he has will destroy Lanyon, but he also knows that Lanyon is not going to be able to turn down this opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if we look at some of the metaphors here, because it's often the easiest things to analyze are metaphors. There's some quite interesting ones that tell us quite a lot about this relationship. So the first one is the figurative idea of Jekyll's knowledge being a new province that can transport Lanyon to a new world of ideas and science beyond his narrow and material views.
I do apologize. So he's almost saying that this knowledge will transport him physically to a new, brave new world, a new place where he won't be limited by his own small-mindedness.
Yeah, it's drawing upon metaphors of exploration, of you know, making him an explorer, not simply a scientist, but an explorer, finding new places beyond the imagination of other scientists.
Yes.
And the idea of Lanyon as being narrow and material is a deliberate juxtaposition between the two. Narrow suggesting that he's close-minded, limited, unable to see the bigger picture. The idea of his views being material, being, you know, fundamentally grounded in the physical world, whilst implying that Jekyll has moved beyond this. His science is therefore more advanced. It's taken him to places that other fin de siècle scientists couldn't dream of.
Right, exactly. He's almost drunk on the power, even though, ironically, it's his knowledge, Jekyll's knowledge has led to his own destruction, as in that Mr. Hyde will eventually consume and destroy him. He's still reveling, or Hyde particularly, is delighting and reveling in this new knowledge and this new frontier that he's driven forwards.
And I think what's so interesting also here is that in a novel where religion is surprisingly absent, the imagery is saturated with religious connotations. So he talks about how Lanyon, on seeing him transform from Hyde into Jekyll, will be, "Your sight shall be blasted by a prodigy to stagger the unbelief of Satan." Mm-hmm. You know, the suggestion here is that, you know, that actually he's inverting this relationship between belief and God by implying that he is like a God. Because in this comparison, he is not Satan. Actually, in this comparison, Lanyon is Satan and he is God. And actually, the violent verb blasted implies that this knowledge is going to harm him, that Jekyll is somehow omnipotent like God. He's all powerful. He, like God, thrusts Satan out of heaven, for not believing in him, is going to thrust Lanyon out of this new scientific heaven that he's created. You know, his power, his knowledge is making him into a divine figure, is what he seemed to be arguing here.
Yeah, that science has taken him beyond and made him something even greater than the divine, perhaps. And then you've got this point about the irony, which is that actually Jekyll is talking about where there's an irony is that he's actually representing the story of the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, well, in the sense that Jekyll is comparing himself to God, while at the same time taking on the role of the serpent in that story, in the biblical story of Genesis, because he is tempting Lanyon with knowledge that goes beyond what would have been deemed natural by Victorian readers. So actually,
you mean Hyde is doing this at this point?
Yeah. So Hyde is although he's comparing himself to God, is actually taking on the role of the serpent in the Garden of Eden.
Yes.
Tempting Lanyon towards this knowledge that is unnatural, that will harm him, that will send him out of paradise.
Absolutely.
Or kill him.
Right. Fantastic. So paragraph two, having argued in paragraph one that Lanyon is the more measured, the more good side of Jekyll, and of course, in this particular instance, the Hyde part of Jekyll, and is tempted by him, we would then move on to talking about that there was this friendship between Jekyll and Lanyon, that before all of this stuff with Hyde happened, the two men were indeed friends.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point, because the topic sense I said, however, it's important to note that early on in the novel, Stevenson makes Jekyll and Lanyon friends, suggesting that they are not that different beyond a minor scientific disagreement.
Right, so perhaps the role of Lanyon is to highlight how beliefs, particularly scientific beliefs, are more powerful perhaps than just relationships, that they can come overpower friendships, that in this new world of science, people are these new learnings and these new beliefs are very, very powerful, and they are powerful enough to drive people apart.
But also the idea that actually even before he transformed into Hyde, Jekyll was the same man, because a crucial part of this novel is actually that Hyde is a part of Jekyll. The drug does not bring an evil side into him. It simply reveals to the world that part of Jekyll's psyche that he'd repressed, that he'd hidden from society. It lets people see that evil in this physical manifestation of his evil. So actually, I think their friendship's so important here, because it shows it kind of undermines this theory of physiognomy. That is the belief that evil people, as Cesare Lombroso, the criminologist, argued at this time, you could see their evil in their face. This is undermining that. It's implying that Jekyll's evil side, his ambitious nature, his kind of hidden foul desires, were hidden behind a well-made, smooth-faced man, as described in chapter three, a man who has every mark of capacity and kindness. Actually, there's a sense that actually Lanyon was totally unconscious of that he didn't know this man, and it's only on seeing Hyde that he realizes who his friend really was all along, and that I think is the shock that kills him.
And this mirrors Victorian fear, of course, doesn't it? This mirrors Victorian fear that there could be evil hidden behind the nice veneer of polite, educated, upper-class society, particularly, of course, brought to light later by the sort of Jack the Ripper, and this idea that that he could have been a member of the aristocracy, he could have been an educated man who was committing these terrible deeds. Jekyll and Hyde as a novella almost preempts that fear, right?
Yeah, and there's this horrible, in chapter two, there's this ironic kind of simile that compares them to the Greek philosophers Damon and Pythias, whose friendship was so strong that actually Damon put up his life for Pythias as bail. So the irony is, of course, that Lanyon does die because of Jekyll, but not out of sacrifice, but out of shock and disgust. So it's showing again that the power of realizing the truth, the danger of realizing actually, who someone really is, it can actually kill. And I think the metaphor that encapsulates the difference between them is actually in the final chapter 10, when we learn that unlike Lanyon, who is as he seems, Hyde sees Jekyll as nothing more than a cavern in which he conceals himself from his pursuit. The idea, therefore, that this theory, it subverts this theory of physiognomy, as I said, that actually he seems no different from his peers. He seems to Lanyon someone who is kind, who's well-made, who's part of respected society, and yet actually, like Robert Knox, like Declan Brodie, like Jack the Ripper himself, who's thought to have been a surgeon, actually criminality can be hidden, that actually we don't necessarily know who is really that evil.
Right, so first paragraph, we're talking about Lanyon being presented as the opposite of Jekyll, who is tempted by Jekyll's alter ego, Hyde, and ultimately destroyed. And we see Lanyon as the more measured, the more conservative type of scientist who respects the power of science, unlike Jekyll, who wants to push it as far as he possibly can. Then in paragraph two, we explore the idea that their friendship was interesting, that actually the fact that they could have been friends shows us how the evil in us is actually often very well hidden, even from the people who know us very, very well. And ultimately, we see the difference between the two of them is that Lanyon is more as Lanyon presented himself, whereas Hyde is this monstrous part of Jekyll that comes out and doesn't even care for that version of Jekyll. This leads us then into paragraph three, right?
Yeah, so looking actually, I think perhaps the ultimate difference is their reactions towards Hyde. So Stevenson makes the difference between Jekyll and Lanyon most clear in their reactions towards Hyde. Whilst Jekyll is seduced by the bestial world that Hyde opens up for him, Lanyon is so shocked that he dies. So in chapter 9, Lanyon says that seeing Hyde, his soul sickened, his life was shaken to the roots. Interesting metaphors there, you know, the idea of this being a sickness, a pathogen, a disease that's fatally infected him, shaken to his roots, the idea and that he's, the very basis of his existence has been destroyed.
If you think about a tree being held upright by its roots, your roots also being having connotations of where you come from, the thing that gives you identity, for these to be shaken, as you say, it is suggesting that the very thing that would hold you to your identity and your convictions is somehow being torn apart.
And dear listener, a really important thing to note here is that actually when analysing metaphors, it's really important you don't just say what the effect is. You say, how does it work? You say,
so many marks available when students do that, and students so often forget to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So by contrast, when Jekyll transforms into Hyde in chapter 10, he says that his sensations were indescribably new, incredibly sweet. He felt younger, lighter, happier in body. So disturbingly, this unnatural metamorphosis actually is something that's desirable, that criminality itself seems to imply here is you know, seductive. And this ids in with later Freudian theories about the id, the ego, and the superego, implying that kind of actually your most basic and primitive desires, which Freud called the id, are actually highly seductive. There's something that you want. Which is a terrifying idea.
Well, it goes, if you relate it to the Darwinian thing, humans needed those, in the Darwinian model, you needed those desires in order to survive, right? Because you needed to become the strongest, the most reproductive, the fittest, all of these things. And that's, according to the Darwinian model, that is how humanity got to be where it is. So, of course, those desires must have been powerful, otherwise we wouldn't have evolved as we did, presumably.
Yeah, so there's one more simile that I pick out on the sheet before we finish here is that Jekyll describes his desires for Hyde as running like a mill race. So, you know, like the fast-flowing water powering a mill, his evil thoughts are just like unstoppable, powering his imagination. Mm. They're this world, they've opened up a world to him that he wants, whereas Lanyon, when he sees this world, is destroyed by it, is killed.
Yeah. And therefore you see the dangers of giving in to those desires, or perhaps the danger, another way of reading it, is to suppress those desires completely, because part of what made Hyde so powerful is because Jekyll had lived a life where he didn't have recourse to let his desires out in any way, right? He couldn't, by putting up the constant image of respectability, these desires grew stronger in him. So perhaps what we're seeing is, in a character like Jekyll, the explosive nature of trying to suppress all of your human desires, right? Whereas someone like Lanyon is able to do this and live a happy and contented life, someone like Jekyll is not.
Yeah, so I guess it's quite kind of a modern argument in that sense about actually the need to talk about your feelings and acknowledge what you're thinking, or else they'll kind of manifest themselves in these disturbing, eruptive, you know, force.
Absolutely. I mean, the first time I read this novel, I thought it had incredible parallels with it, particularly modern discourse around mental health and particularly male mental health. You know, the idea that men not talking about their feelings leads to often very, very negative consequences. I thought Robert Louis Stevenson shows an incredibly astute understanding of the human brain a long time before these sort of modern ideas about the different sections of the mind and all of that came along. So yeah, fascinating AO3 point to explore there.
Yeah, and I think then the final point for our conclusion really is just that Lanyon and Utterson don't actually seem that different from Jekyll until we find out this revelation that he is Hyde. So it's this kind of troubling, that's what was troubling about this novel, is that, you know, unlike earlier Gothic novels where evil is portrayed as something external that breaks into the moral Victorian world, what's so disturbing about here is the sense that evil is lurking beneath the surface, and even a relationship, a friendship as close as Lanyon and Jekyll can, you know, even in that friendship you can still be unconscious of, you know, something that's truly evil that you're missing right in front of your eyes.
I think that's the most terrifying thing, isn't it? When you hear about monstrous people who've done sort of terrible, terrible things, what is perhaps most frightening about them is the normality of them, and the idea that, you know, someone who has committed genocide or done some terrible crime against humanity, the fact that they could love their children is almost more frightening. Do you see what I mean? That idea that they could have some form of normality about them, i.e. to have a family and still do these terrible things, that to me is more terrifying than just being able to think of them as this complete inhuman monster.
Yeah, it's the idea that this inhuman monster might even be your English teacher.
What a horrible, horrible note to end that on. Right, well, thank you for joining us. And we hope, I think that was a tricky topic, and I hope we've simplified it a bit. Remember that when you're listening to these podcasts, it's not essential that you grasp every little thing and fully follow every structural point that we're making or the structure of the whole essay. You can just listen to these podcasts and take two or three ideas that you want to work with. It doesn't require you to grasp every single word that we say in order for these to be effective and to help you. You can, of course, access all our other podcasts at the on your podcast app, or if you go to englishrevisionpod.co.uk, you can access all of our previous episodes, all of the handouts we've created, and you can follow us on Twitter at GRevisionPod, where we will update you whenever we have new episodes coming out and that kind of thing. Anything else you want to add, Mr. Forster?
No, that's the lot, I think.
That's the me of it. Right, happy 2020, and we will be back with some new material very, very soon.